Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 5th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 6 and is titled, Us and Them. Can you have an us without a them? Let's listen in.
This is Ann Peterson, and this session is titled, Us and Them. Is it possible to have an us without a them? I'd like to introduce myself and the sessions for the upcoming week. I just finished teaching this last week. We've been up in Holden about a week. Finished a session using Norman MacLean's book, Young Men and Fire, and a session on God's presence in the world in the midst of pain and suffering and evil. And this week, I am switching to a different theme, and we'll look at it from a variety of different ways. Overall, the theme is titled Us and Them, which sort of underlies the question of how we deal with issues of unity and diversity, of plurality, of unity. How do we deal with the fact that there are lots of divisions and differences among us in our society, and what does that have to say about the Christian faith? A little promotion for the bookstore. I did well enough that all the books sold out last week from Young Men and Fire, and I'll be using a sort of a subtext again through this week. Again, it's not something that you have to have read in order to participate in the sessions by any means. But I'm going to lift up a book that I'd like you to at least think about if you're up here for a few days and you're looking for a good book to read. This is a novel, and I'd like to recommend it. It's over in the bookstore under the area called Staff Recommendations. It's a book by Ole Rolvad called Their Father's God. I'll put his name up on the board. Some of you may have read you read Rolvad? Okay, Giants in the Earth. Did you finish the trilogy?
I did a master's degree in Rolvad.
Oh, you did? Wonderful. Well, gee, I probably should shut up and let you.
Long time ago.
Rolvad's three books, of which Pater Victorious is sort of, I just sort of skimmed through that. That's kind of the least familiar in my memory. But Rolvad is a Norwegian immigrant. Came from Norway, from a small fishing village in the area called Nordland. Had dreams of becoming an artist, poet, writer, and came to America, and for a while worked down in Elk Point, South Dakota, near his uncle's ranch, I believe, farm, and then eventually went to St. Olaf, where he went to school, and then returned to Norway for a year to work on Norwegian literature, and came back to St. Olaf, where he taught for many, many years. I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I teach at Augustana College, and right across the street is sort of a memorial. I found out that the only thing that Rolvad did in this house was slept there during his wedding night, I guess, but Ole Rolvad and Jenny Burdahl's house, her parents' house is situated across the street from Augustana College, and so there's all kinds of memorabilia to Rolvad. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time at the end of the session talking about why I think this book is so applicable and important for us to read as late 20th century Americans. The text of this book and the story of it, I'll go into more detail later, but the immediate story is about a young Norwegian man, Peter Holm, who falls in love with an Irish Catholic girl, Susie Doheny. And it's the ensuing story of their marriage and how the community receives it in Dakota Territory around the turn of the century. And they eventually have a young son. And the conflicts that ensue in the two families, the Catholics versus the Lutheran, the Irish versus the Norwegian, about how they understand the diversity and difference among them. And Rolvad clearly has some warnings to our community and to people, particularly at that time, about the loss of identity, the role of tradition, and the way we look at conflicts. And the height of the conflict in the book ensues over baptism. As we look at our theme this week of water washed and spirit born, you might think about, and we're going to talk about this much at length later in sessions during the week, there's one I've entitled The Body of Christ Broken for You, literally, how the sacraments are the symbols of the unity of the church and yet have often become the very place within Christendom where we have split, and for which in congregations some of the most vicious fights occur. So we're going to talk later in the week, both from Rohlbach's perspective and from sort of a historical theological perspective, how the sacraments themselves are really symbols of both unity and diversity, and how that holds both problem and possibility. So I'll go more into length with Rohlbach's story later to sort of entice you to pick up this book. It's a very, Rohlbach is sort of a writer of prairie tragedy, of epic tragedy, highly influenced by Henrik Ibsen. It was his favorite Norwegian playwright. Some of you may know The Doll's House. If you have read that play, you'll be well prepared for this book. I think the influence of A Doll's House is linked into Rohlbach's understanding of giants in the earth, and which is the first of this trilogy. So the first book that Rohlbach writes that becomes sort of internationally famous is Giants in the Earth. Again, full, sort of rich with sacramental imagery. Then Pater Victorious, and finally Their Father's God. I want to read just one little tiny quote. The opening couple pages, the prairie itself becomes a character in Rohlbach's books. And having been born and raised in Montana, when I became engaged to my husband, I said, hell will freeze over before I'll ever live in South Dakota, because I thought it was the most vast, open area of absolute nothing I had ever seen. Couldn't imagine being happy there. Thought it was just sort of where God had forgotten to do something. So ironically, of course, after I finished my PhD, the first job opening that we applied for was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So we are now prairie dwellers, and I am eating my words. So, but there's a little quote in the beginning from a family who is moving out of Dakota Territory, and it says in huge yellow letters on the canvas, the owner had painted his defiant farewell. 50 miles from water, 100 miles from wood, to hell with South Dakota, we're leaving you for good. Okay. It said the whole country was scorched, every field burnt up, settlers had abandoned all hope of ever establishing homes in that cursed place. As for him, he wouldn't give a cent for the whole goddamn prairie. The man raged, desperation burnt in his eyes. And so the book begins with the opening of the hot prairie. A number of years ago, now we've been sort of flooded in South Dakota, the floods that swept through much of the Midwest. But when we first came there, the summers, the land is of extremes. If you've lived anywhere, probably in the Midwest, how many of you are Midwesterners? Yeah, you know what kind of harsh extremes the land can bring. From extreme cold, 40 below zero kind of wind chill, to in the summer where the heat index can go up to 100. And I remember sitting in our one-bedroom apartment in Chicago when I was at the seminary, and a bunch of us were working at the Augsburg Fortress bookstore, and we were the only people in our stairwell that were wealthy enough to own a room air conditioner. So the whole staff from the bookstore came over and made tuna fish sandwiches and sat on our bed in the air conditioning to relieve ourselves from the heat. That same kind of extremes sets up geographically the kind of spiritual extremes and social extremes that Rohlbach will examine in his book about how we begin to deal with difference. Okay? So I would encourage you, if you have the time, to pick up this book. It reads fairly rapidly, and the titles of the chapters are extremely important. You'll notice a movement through the chapter titles that narrates the story of the faith. And of course, as one of my students pointed out, the title of the book is very significant. It's not Our Father's God. It's Their Father's God. And that title, the original title of the book in Norwegian was called The Blessed Day. So this title was a later English version added, but the original title of the book was called The Blessed Day, kind of conjuring up the imagery of the day in the future when all people will come together, the biblical image of beyond judgment where we come together in unity and blessedness and hope for the future. And of course, Rohlbach must have had a rather ironic twist on that notion of the blessed day. So head to the bookstore, and if you have some moments, I'd highly encourage you to pick up Their Father's God. I use this every year with my first year students and find that it is the single book to which they become the most deeply involved emotionally. For many of them, this is their family heritage. Mixed religious marriages or racial marriages or other conflicts that ensue in the families, and find that they don't know how to deal with those kinds of conflicts. Okay? So that's sort of an introduction to that. Just a little bit about where this title came from. This title is originally off a syllabus that I teach for 2 years. Another colleague and I, a New Testament scholar at Augustana, Richard Swanson, and I taught the freshman religion course, and we're allowed to design it any way we want to. So we titled it Us and Them. Is it possible to have an us without a them? To look at the issues of how we begin to negotiate this delicate question of the promise of one Lord, one faith, one baptism, right? Nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. And you can think of all the promises in Scripture that talk about the unity of the faith, the unity of creation, God's promise to bring everything together, and yet the very fragmented, fractured society we live in. And to talk about difference both as promise and problem. So part of the strategy for this course was a setting up of readings and different participatory events to talk about how students face difference. For many of Augustana students, about 52% of our students are Lutheran. Most of them come from rural farm communities in South Dakota, and for many of them, encountering Sioux Falls is their first encounter of the big city. After having lived in Hyde Park, that's sort of a wake-up call. But for many of those students, it's the first time that they may be living with a roommate who's completely different than they are. Finding that they're falling in love with somebody who's not of their own faith. Or engaging at least in some sort of racial and pluralistic difference within Sioux Falls for these students. And what we've talked about is how do you begin to deal with difference. And one of the strategies that we used in this class was to have one of the drama teachers come and teach us staged combat. If you've ever, you know, when the fights occur on stage, of course what you realize in theater is that those are highly choreographed, carefully matched encounters. And the drama teacher took us into the gym, into our big Elman Center complex, for about 2 to 3 class periods. And we were paired up, and we learned how to stage fights with each other. What students learned about that is that it's very difficult and very problematic how to engage in conflict without hurting the other. And what we found out is that the staged combat brought up all kinds of issues for people. Like, I will never forget, one man was paired with a pregnant woman, and no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't act out. He was so trained not to hurt. You know, and we got into these issues about size and care and how you begin to engage in these staged acts of violence. And what that taught us was that in order to engage in difference, which sometimes ensues hostility, we end up shooting the neighbor, that we need to practice to take care with how we cross these boundaries of difference. So there are about 3 questions that I want you to keep in mind, 3 or 4 questions you may think of others during the course of this week. In the face of so many differences, how do you talk to someone who disagrees with you? As part of this religion course, I think our students thought we'd flipped our lids. The very first text that we gave them is Deborah Tannen's book, which is sitting actually over in the bookstore, called That's Not What I Meant. Deborah Tannen, sort of a popular sociolinguist who looks at how, particularly across gender lines, men and women talk with each other. And what she talks about is the fact that styles and conversation can reflect differences in how we relate to one another. And particularly, she does a nice job, I think, of the analysis of power and its dimensions in conversation. So how do you talk to somebody specifically over religious and theological issues that matter, for which your belief seems non-negotiable. How do you know who is right? How do you know who is wrong? Does that matter? Is that the right question? How do you know who belongs and who doesn't? How do you know who's an us and a them? We're going to come back to that question in just a minute. I think those questions of us and them are important because they have marked the history of the Christian church. From the very beginning, Christianity had to learn its identification along with and over against other communities of faith. I learned the early Christological claims, what we know about Jesus, the first four councils of the early church were often questions of us and them. Right, the Arians, the ones who were condemned as heretics, were actually the ones who controlled theology for generations. Who wins, who doesn't? Of course, one of the first major, going to help me, it's either 1054 or 1056. I always get my dates wrong. I think it's 1056. When the East and the West split, one of the first major divisions within Christendom. Then, of course, you come along with the Reformation, and the body of Christ literally is broken. So the Lutherans are inheritors of those who talk about the body of Christ being broken. And of course, we fractured into all kinds of denominations. I'm not saying that's wrong, but it's looking at the sort of roadmap of who we are as a Christian faith. That while at one point we talk about unity and being of one faith, we also have to look at the divisions and splits among us. A quote for you. From Walter Wink's book. Anybody Walter Wink fan? I believe this is Engaging the Powers. He has about four different books, Transforming Powers, Engaging the Powers, Naming the Powers. I've only read bits and pieces. But this quote I think is highly significant for how this week we'll look at what I think is a spiritual issue. He says, "I submit that the ultimate religious question today should no longer be the Reformation question, how can I find a gracious God? But rather, how can we find God in our enemies? What guilt was for Luther, the enemy has become for us, the goad that can drive us to God. What has been a purely private affair, justification by grace through faith, has now in our age grown to embrace the world. We can no more save ourselves from our enemies than we can save ourselves from sin. But God's amazing grace offers to save us from both." Let me read that little opening line again. "I submit that the ultimate religious question today should no longer be the Reformation's question, how can I find a gracious God, but rather, how can we find God in our enemies?" Okay. I remember when the decade, when 1990 turned, and Time magazine had a whole cover of what to expect in the next decade. It was kind of the closing of the Cold War, the nuclear images of nuclear holocaust, which we're remembering this week during the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, had kind of quieted down a bit. And there was a whole section in that Time magazine about how conflict would become more local. The threat of giant world wars may seem less threatening, and the threat of small localized conflicts around the globe would be what might mark the way that conflict would occur. And all you have to do is think back to the few events in this last month, and we realize that it's more like putting out small brush fires and less like worrying about whether just the Russians are our enemies, Soviet power, which is now again fragmented itself. I've mentioned this last week, and another way of describing this religious question is the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whose story and writings I've undertaken in a new way again this year. And for Bonhoeffer, that really became the religious question, the man who was martyred by the Nazis for participating in a plot to assassinate Hitler. How do you talk about loving your enemy? And of course that whole complex of questions becomes very difficult. How do you wrestle with who is your enemy and how do we relate to them? So that sort of is the religious framework for how we talk about what the spiritual question is and the ensuing kinds of descriptions of who we are. Tuesday's session will be titled Where You Stand Determines What You See, kind of a commentary on what I call social location and what I would call this conflict between, you hear words being thrown around all the time like enlightenment, post-enlightenment, modern, post-modern, trying to get sort of a look at what the contemporary landscape is that has contributed to these feelings of people feeling decentered, dislocated, uneasy, concerned about what's true. The third session will look at this notion of the body of Christ broken for you, the sacraments as the images of both unity and brokenness. The fourth session will, I've titled A Spiritual Landscape, to look at how we understand geographically and spiritually where our differences ensue. And here's another book I can recommend to you. I hadn't put it on the list, but they have quite a few copies of it over there. Dakota, some of you, I see
a few. I just bought it.
Did you? Good.
At home, not here.
Okay, a few faces are lighting up. Written by Kathleen Norris. It's a combination of small essays and a few poems and sort of reflections on the image of Dakota, in this case West River, about its image, actually linking it to the desert, to the Cappadocian Fathers, and to the hospitality that she's experienced in monastic communities. She's a Protestant herself, but has spent a lot of time in monastic communities, particularly the Benedictines. And it's a marvelous reflection, too, on life in small town. She returned to the area where her grandmother was from in Lemon, South Dakota. We've driven up through there several times. I think it's on Highway 12. Very small, very isolated community. She also has a new book out called The Cloister Walk, which is her reflections on living with the Benedictines up at St. John's in Collegeville. So we'll take a look a little bit at how geography and our sort of spiritual landscape tells us who we are. And then the final session is to look at sort of a strategy for how we deal with all this difference. How do we talk about it theologically? Okay. Comments or questions so far? Okay. What I'd like to do for the next few minutes is to get some input from you so that we can have sort of an understanding together what we're talking about. What I'd like to do is to spend a few moments talking about what it means to be an us and what it means to be a them. I think all of us, just the title from the blackboard or the kiosk out there, somebody came up to me and said, oh, I have a description about what an us and a them is. And she told me about her husband who works, I think both of them maybe work at the state, I think it's the state school. And they've changed the title of the residents from residents to clients. And the director said, so we can tell us from them. Okay? So that was just sort of an illustrative example of how we begin to distinguish groups of people and what makes somebody an us and what makes somebody them, who belongs and who doesn't. And I want to get to the second kind of part of that, which is what qualities, how do we know who's an us and them? Some of the more marked experiences I have that are childhood memories. Some pretty clear delineations, especially in junior high girls, who was in and who was out, right? Okay. So I'd like to just get some feedback from you about how you would understand who us and them are, what your experiences are, or what you think are prevalent problems and questions in our culture and society that gives indication of who us and them are.
The decision makers and the people who have to follow those rules.
Okay.
Being on the opposite ends of an issue.
Okay.
And welfare mothers.
Oh, good.
taxpayers.
I have a close friend of mine, Augustana, who's finishing her PhD, and she's writing on stigmatization. She's in media and journalism, and she's writing on the stigmatization of the media towards welfare mothers. And the sort of resurgence of saying women, parents belong in the home to raise their children, but of course, at the same time that they're supposed to be out working full time. So it's sort of a setup there, isn't it? Okay? What else?
Try as we may, we've tried to learn not to pay attention to differences in color and dress and manners, but we do.
Okay.
We still have that feeling of difference.
Sometimes that can be both positive and negative. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's a psycholinguist, and before I knew what her occupation was, spends her whole time analyzing what people say. I had talked, just visiting with her, and she says, "You must have relatives from Western Pennsylvania." I thought, boy, how does she know that? My dad grew up in the area near Pittsburgh, and it was my sentence structure. It's that old Pennsylvania Deutsch, plus a few odd pronunciations of things, like, put me in the slice of toast.
Huh? It's fixed.
Yeah. And instead of saying, put a slice of toast in for me, I always say, put me in a slice of toast. I mean, there were just weird little linguistic structures that you could talk about. And some of those can become very unpopular. So.
Yeah, like with the homeless, I see the SMMM is like the homeless or the handicapped or the groups that you don't have understanding.
Okay.
Those who can afford it and those who can't.
Okay. South Dakota's economy has just been given a D. You know, some of these giant, I don't know who these groups are that do these sort of economic indicators, but for a while South Dakota, I think, had a B or C in its rating for its economy, and it's recently been downgraded. It has one of the fastest growing gaps in the country between the wealthy and the poor. I'm always just mortified at the salaries we pay our staff at Augustana. There were people who were working on maintenance who for a while were qualifying for food stamps. And it takes two families in most cases to make ends meet, and yet in areas of town where you drive out, the $200,000 and $300,000 houses are going up. I mean, they can't build them fast enough.
Yeah.
South Dakota also has the lowest, at least it did for a while, labor wage in the country, and it still has the lowest teacher's wage. So it's kind of an interesting combination of those who afford it and those who can't, and it seems as if the gap, at least experientially in South Dakota, is becoming much, much greater. And you can see it in how people just live, houses. I mean, some of those places look like I'd have to have 18 kids and 5 grandparents and 4, I mean, dogs just to take up the kinds of house space that part of Sioux Falls is. What other kinds of?
Churched people and non-church people.
Okay.
Homosexuals and...
Okay.
I was thinking, adding on to the color, dress, manners difference, prejudice plus power versus,
the powerless.
Powerless. Okay. Which often goes with poverty or...
Right.
Those who can't have voice.
Children and adults.
Yeah.
What are they discussing?
female up there? Mm-hmm. People who can fix their car, you know, with a and other people who can get ripped off, you know.
The employed versus the unemployed.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a bit of Ford and Jet.
Yeah.
Majority and minority.
Trades and professions.
Okay.
Did you have a personality scope?
Married and unmarried, childless and
breeders.
Sorry.
And what? Breeders? I had a friend in high school who used to call breeder pics. It was awful.
The immigrant and the person who's been here.
Okay. I have a letter to Sheriff in a little bit that I cut out of this false paper. This is a hot topic around Sioux Falls. I suppose it is in a lot of communities.
Clergy and laity.
Yeah.
Church council and not church
council.
So maybe church council versus the leaders of the church?
Yeah. No.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. What about within religious or spiritual kinds of conflicts? What sort of issues would you lift up as us and them?
The born again.
Okay.
The Mormons or somebody who are not
absolutely
Christian.
Born again versus another way of sort of the long life baptism sort of ethos.
Versus us.
Yeah.
The death.
The right there.
Okay. What else?
Literalist versus.
Literalist versus. Well, wait. See, it's hard. It's tougher to start putting labels on it. Versus. Oh yeah. I mean, we can stand it down when they're not literalists, but.
Fundamentalism. Yeah.
Christians and non-Christians.
Yeah.
Well, it's church and non-church.
We spent a lot of time on that one in our freshman religion course. We read the books Maus. Are you familiar with those?
Maus.
The cartoon. Yeah. Cartoon. It sounds rather crass, but it's a cartoon characterization of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
The mice are the Jews, the cats are the Germans.
The Nazis, I think.
Yeah, right, the Nazis, not just Germans. The big sort of happy, sloppy dogs are the Americans. And it's a very powerful articulation of this question of Christian and non-Christian. We specifically get into the Jewish-Christian. I'm not in any way an expert on that. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's a particular burden, I think, for Christians, how to deal with that post-Holocaust and post-Luther. Living our own traditions from Lutheran theology problems with that. Okay, we've got all kinds of things up there. I'm going to erase just a little bit of this. And we got out some of this, but how do you know who's an us and a them? I mean, we sort of put labels on all things, but what are the distinguishing issues or characteristics or structures that mark an us and them?
Well, you have to know where you are, don't you? I mean, to compare. You understand the nuances without having someone explain to you, just have an understanding.
Okay. It's almost an intuitive thing?
Intuitive, that's good. Or you're taught.
Okay.
You've got to be carefully taught.
So people are too late before you are 5, 6, 7, 8.
But a lot of the us and them attitude is based on our own prejudices. Mm-hmm. So
well, we get them from somewhere.
What else marks the two groups? You mentioned the issue of power. Those who have it and those who don't. One of the big us and them categories on campuses is faculty versus administration and students versus faculty. Often complaining that certain groups have more power than others. But,
well, related to that, the majority issue.
Okay.
Numerical superiority.
Yep. Sheer numbers.
Or sheer, I don't know how to say this, like the squeaky wheel, mm-hmm. is the intention.
But the loudest voice, yeah. The one who complains the most, the
but
one who makes
the most. After a while, the squeaky wheel gets replaced.
Yeah.
If you're lucky.
Money?
Money, yeah, economic.
There seems to be a defining issue.
Okay. Our campuses have constant heated debates over the last couple of years about the whole issue of sexuality. And that has been an issue that has defined the politics of the campus. This year we have an arts film society in Sioux Falls, and they decide to use the facilities at Augustana this year. And so one of the movies that they showed, and I feel bad for saying I didn't get to it yet, is Priest. Mm-hmm. Which has caused all kinds of controversy, and the diocese in Sioux Falls just went ballistic, and our president of our college got all kinds of hate, and I don't know, I haven't seen it, maybe it's, but from what I've heard at least, it was a very powerful film, but there was a lot of anger in the community. It ensued into lots of letters to the editor about how awful Augustana could do this. And then there were some corresponding ones that became supportive, saying this was a risk for this college to do this, and it became an open forum for discussion. And they did try to set up a discussion afterwards, inviting people who were concerned about the portrayal of Roman Catholic priests and the kind of discussion that needed to follow. So there was some movement to not just show the film and end the discussion, but to invite community participation. But usually there is a defining issue.
Security or insecurity?
Yeah.
Personal or otherwise?
One of the sort of qualities that I think marks concern about us and them is those kinds of divisions can feel threatening. And whether you feel sort of, and security can be both good and bad. Mm-hmm. If you're secure in the sense of who you are, those divisions may not be so threatening. However, the security can also fall over to arrogance or I have the only truth. Yeah. I think one of the issues that's also key is how we define what truth is. We're going to talk about this a lot more tomorrow, but I think there's still an understanding in our culture that it's inherited from the Enlightenment, from saying that there's a universal truth that applies to everybody. And somehow the process of education or of Christianity is to find the truth. And of course what our culture is experiencing is that there's all kinds of localized truths. Right? It's very difficult to talk about truth, capital T, when there are experiences of different religious truth, social truth. So I think truth becomes part of this issue of us and them.
I think our own senses of inferiority have a lot to do with it. If there's anything we feel inferior to, that becomes of them.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Our own sense of place in the world and how we feel over against.
Our experience of pain or not experience with it.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I think human experience of pain, quite often you can relate to others.
So it's a question of empathy and being with someone. If you haven't had that experience, it can be threatening. Mm-hmm.
That's the source of all support groups.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? That's where those us-them distinctions will often break down in some sort of way, where people are brought together under the experience of, you know, it can be support groups for 12-step work, for loss of, a lot of work has been done on, there's a person on our campus who specializes in people who have lost children to early death, and the sorts of connections that bring you together over that.
Or you could say need. I mean, you could also look at that from the end of, because if we're looking at it from the welfare mother's point of view, she needs to go to welfare. Mm-hmm. That changes.
Changes the dynamic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Keep those things in mind. Here's a little letter I picked up from the Sioux Falls paper. That Sioux Falls is probably, I wish I knew the statistics of what the sort of spread of diversity in the Sioux Falls area is, but it's predominantly populated by Euro-Americans, primarily German, Norwegian, some, I think, Russian, but primarily a homogeneous community, and there's been some influx, I know, all the way through across southern Minnesota, well, of diverse populations moving in, of immigration, and Lutheran Social Service has been part of bringing in the families, helping families relocate. And there's a growing number of Spanish-speaking people in Sioux Falls, and they recently, I thought it was really exciting, dedicated the first Spanish-speaking church in Sioux Falls. The diocese. One good thing about our new bishop is that he's really been promoting the Spanish-speaking community and helping around issues of poverty and getting people good wages. Here's a letter from a citizen in Sioux Falls. I'm sure the dedication of Our Lady of Guadalupe was a joyous event for the Spanish-speaking population of the Sioux Falls community. As Cardinal Keeler pointed out, it's an American tradition that as each wave of immigrants reached America, ethnic groups gathered to worship in churches using their native tongues. To attest to that, the Upper Midwest is dotted with small rural churches where Swedish, Norwegian, German, and Dutch were once the predominant languages. But these immigrants dug in and built their own churches. They didn't sit back and wait for a ready-made church to be handed to them. What really troubled me was the interview with a 23-year-old woman who has lived in Sioux Falls since she was 11. Yet she can't speak enough English to get along without an interpreter. 12 years, more than half her life in Sioux Falls, but she hasn't bothered to learn to speak English. That really bothers me. They want to enjoy the bounties of the American way of life, but they don't want to give up any of their own culture. Then why did they leave it in the first place? The Northern European immigrants espouse the culture of their new land. True. They have their festival days when they celebrate the culture of their native lands. The Irish have St. Patrick's Day, the Scandinavians their Nordland Fest, the Dutch their Tulip Festival, and the Czechs Czech Days. But after it's over, they go back to being ordinary, hardworking American citizens. Those kind of letters have been coming and going, and we have a new governor in the state. I think he's been elected a year or two, Bill Janklo, whose comment about why he worked on Native American Day was, well, they don't have a Caucasian Day. So he spent his time, after the former governor had worked really quite extensively on establishing the Year of Reconciliation between Native, non-Native. It's been sort of an interesting process with our new governor, sort of the rhetoric of, you know, they don't have a Caucasian Day, so I'll work during Native American Day. And I think there's been almost a, from what I've gathered talking to other South Dakotans, kind of a move away from reconciliation and all the work that's been taking over lots of years, the incredible split that still occurs, at least in our state, with the Native American communities. My husband grew up on an open reservation, and when we go up to Sisseton, there's the Native American Catholic Church, the Native American Lutheran Church, the Native American, and then there's the white Catholic Church. And it's just a kind of an interesting process about how the community has learned to live with and against each other.
Thank
think another characteristic that we might list up here that distinguishes us from them is ignorance. I'm still just amazed at how students understand each other as Lutheran and Catholic. That's still one of the more obvious. That has changed a lot in South Dakota, but there's still quite a distinction between Catholics and Lutherans. And I still have students who come in, especially Lutheran students, who have the odd ideas about what Catholics are, and vice versa. But I think ignorance does play into some degree about misunderstanding, not listening to, not participating in other people's ways of life. Okay. Another quote. I'm just full of quotes today. Another author whose work that has been helpful for me is a man named David Tracy, a book called Plurality and Ambiguity. David Tracy teaches at the University of Chicago in theology. And he's talking about how these voices, these different voices that we kind of talk as them, or they think of them as us, or us as them, could be put under the category of other. And the question becomes, how does the Christian faith negotiate the boundaries of difference and of other? There's another good book over in the bookstore, if you have time to pick it up, by Paul Sponheim called Faith and the Other. It's a helpful book on looking at this issue. And I've been spending some time reading while I'm up here an introductory book in feminist theology. I teach feminist theology every other year, and I've been reading the book called Freeing Theology, The Essentials of Theology and Feminist Perspective, and looking again at how certain voices within the Christian tradition have been labeled as other, have been silenced, have not been part of us. We could probably put a lot of those same people that we listed over here in this category. The poor, those who don't even have a voice. When you talk about us and them, think about, my mom's been reading these books by Tori Hayden, a woman who works with abused children, how often the abuse of making somebody into a them has so taken away their personhood that they can't speak anymore. Certain groups in the church for whom we don't want to listen to them, and they don't even have a place to speak. I have a friend in Sioux Falls who would like to participate in her own home congregation, but being lesbian is not popular. And the community has a hard time listening to those voices. And theology has often been based on us. And you can put in that category who you want to. As the basis for tomorrow's discussion of sort of social location, we'll re-examine again that text from Matthew 25. When you visit the poor, feed the hungry, and you look at who Jesus associates with and who the gospel is privileged for, it often comes under this category of the other. Those for whom the gospel, for whom the church is often left out. So David Tracy says, the voices of the other multiply. He's talking about our contemporary culture. They seem to be growing, all those considered non-persons by the powerful, but declared by the great prophets to be God's own privileged ones. It's an interesting contrast. All those we consider to be non-persons by the powerful, but God has considered to be the privileged. Their voices can seem strident and uncivil, in a word, other. We have all just begun to sense the terror of that otherness. But only by beginning to listen to those other voices may we also begin to hear the otherness within our own language and within our own selves. So by listening to the voice of the other, you begin to learn what is other in you, the mention of support groups. By listening to the stories of others, you begin to get into touch with those places in yourself which are non-person. What we then might begin to hear above our own chatter are possibilities that we have never dared to dream. So what he's saying is that sometimes these voices seem strident, seem uncivil. As a woman in higher education, I have more than once been told that we're tired of hearing that same old problem about the women being, I mean,
I can't tell you, even just a year ago, a couple of us made a small comment to one of our faculty members about a speech we had heard on campus. Pretty soon it was all over campus that Ann and Janet were all upset again, and if they just keep their mouth shut, we wouldn't have any of this trouble. Okay? That kind of sense that when those who speak out as other, the voices are sometimes hard to listen to. Sometimes become strident, and the discourse isn't smooth, is it? Oftentimes, the language that we want to hear is something that's harmonious and peaceful and kind of keeps the peace. But often when we incorporate voices of the other, the faith has to struggle with discord and disharmony. One of my favorite authors currently is a feminist philosopher of science, Sandra Harding, who talks about the fact that we need to learn to live in the dissonance. It's sort of like learning to live, to listen to, well, Stravinsky probably isn't even a good example, but when 12-tone music came in, some of you are musicians and you listen to certain music, or maybe it's your kids' rock music or whatever, there's no center, there's no key, everything seems, it's learning to live into that and listen to the power of that dissonance. When I played Hindemith for the first time, or played, you know, I was a musician, and I think back to that image of dissonance, it can become a very powerful conveyor. But her claim is that we so often want easy solutions, ways to try to minimize the disagreement, that we don't allow the dissonance to become fruitful. There's a way in which the tension and the dissonance can actually become fruitful. You can learn from those voices who seem strident or uncivil. And I think part of the question we want to struggle with is, how does the Christian faith, what does the Christian faith have to say about this issue of us and them? What have we learned? And what do we consequently say about who God is? Particularly the God that we claim comes in the person of Jesus. I think it's a spiritual quest. I think Walter Wink has an insight about something, which is, maybe for some of us we're still struggling to find a gracious God, but I think embodied in that is the question about how we find grace in those whom we dislike or even hate. And I'm one of those who find it very difficult for people over against whom I feel strongly, they become a them. How do I find grace in that? What is the responsibility of my Christian faith within that context? It's a few minutes for comments or questions.
Does that mean there's no heresy anymore? I mean, we have to hear all this?
Good point. You could put this in a number of ways. Is just anything true? Does every voice carry equal conversation? Is everybody an equal part? First of all, the question is, everybody an equal partner in the conversation? How do we begin to distinguish the issue of truth? Does what we talk about as truth apply to everybody? Or is it so relative that we can say that everybody's opinion accounts? Is Kaczynski's truth about his life and the way he carried it out as true or real or whatever as mine? How do we begin to make distinguishing judgments, particularly from within the Christian community? If we mark this a discussion of the faith, I think that becomes a difficult question. Maybe an example. This feminist philosopher of science has raised the question about the nature of objectivity. The scientific method has often described objective truth as sort of a disembodied, disengaged, the truth is out there, you can sort of reach it objectively in an experiment. What she's saying is, of course, science isn't all that clear. Look at how experiments are funded. All the research that's been done on heart disease for a long time was done primarily and solely on men. Now we're beginning to do research on women. So the nature of that research has changed. There was no perfect scientific truth. The theories of Maxwell are replaced by Einstein, the theories of so on. And science itself, she says, is a history of how truth changes. So this question of heresy becomes one, I think, that, and this is at the heart of Rohlfach's book. How do you understand tradition? That which is passed on. Is tradition a deposit of statements or propositions that we believe that never change? Or has the tradition of the church been what author of this, Elizabeth Johnson, calls a living tradition? That what the Christian faith is about is an engagement, a process, a transition through which each community reinterprets the gospel for its own time. There are certain things that our culture no longer accepts as being faithful to the tradition. One of the most obvious ones is slavery. We have used parts of scripture itself to critique other parts of scripture which says that slavery is okay. And for the ELCA, for Lutherans, we have used other parts of scripture to say that the subordination of women is not part of the gospel. This question of heresy often sets up who's right and who's wrong. And it becomes difficult to discern how we talk about the living tradition, that which is handed on and preserved and important. Part of Rohlfach's warning is that a people who has lost its traditions is doomed. If you have no idea where you've come from. And of course, his understanding of that is that knowing where you've come from doesn't mean turning it into an idol, doesn't mean calcifying it, doesn't mean setting it up as if that truth and that tradition were the only means by which you learn to live in the world. Other comments or questions?
Kind of continuing in that, your own example of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, fighting against Hitler. You know, we can see that was evil. And so I think there are certain things. How do we discern? I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. How do we discern what is truly evil that we should spend our energies on and what is just a product of our own prejudice or what we're talking about today?
It's not just how do you decide what's evil, but how do you counteract it? I mean, yeah. It's committing an evil, that's an old ethical question.
Sure. How do you take a stand? What is it that produces change? Those are not easy questions, and I'm not going to give you any answers this week. I think, but it's helping, particularly for me, the question, we raise it in a number of ways, and I think the way we raise it can shed some new lights. And that's why I bring this reminder back with students that when you read the story of their father's God, Rohlfach was watching a time in American history where immigration, where hundreds of thousands of people were coming into this country. There's a great video on Rohlfach called Letters from America. And during it is interspersed from the governor of Minnesota at that time, Arne Carlson, the incredible kinds of hate literature that was going on, anti-immigration. And students will look at that and say, that sounds like us. I was like, well, yeah, that's the point. But the incredible animosity and the struggle that the immigrants had with bringing over their faith and their traditions and living in a landscape that was hostile and in which many of them were separated by language barriers, by the geography of the place. I think in South Dakota, it was still into the 50s and early 60s when there were still congregations speaking their own language, and that became very unpopular for a while. And now there's almost a resurgence again, interestingly enough, where First Lutheran Downtown has a German service occasion, and then there's the Spanish. So it's kind of this flux back and forth. But Rohlfach's other warning from these texts and from his other writings was watching the growing, what he called, American consumerism. the issue of wealth and money, of power and economic issues that we've talked about, how that began to be the place for which he called the loss of the spiritual fabric of the immigrant, where he feared that American culture would take away from the immigrants their sense of spirituality, their history. So I think this book is a warning about how we get along with each other. And the great thing about this, of course, are all the comments about how the Irish and the Norwegians characterize each other. In this book, the Irish are the messy, you know, they eat all the boiled food and they're kind of dirty, and the Norwegians are very clean and they eat certain other kinds of, down to the food, you know, it's the separation. And how this couple belongs to the same, and this is very interesting, when I talk to students, they'll say they belong to different religions. It takes a whole long time to realize that Christianity is one religion in which there are several denominations. But for many of them, it has become almost the fact that Catholics and Lutherans have become so separate, and at least in this book, that they have become like different religions. They've become two opposite ways of experiencing each other. And yet Rolvag keeps lifting up this theme of how do we face the enemy? How do we face those for whom we characterize as other?
Well, just the Catholic and Lutherans, I'm in Philadelphia, I'm in a very white, blue-collar neighborhood. And it's a really big Catholic neighborhood, and the Protestant churches, they're all tiny little Protestant churches, and then the Catholic church. And the Catholic church is still fairly conservative in Philadelphia, and they believe in purgatory. Mm-hmm. And we had some women come to retreat and pray for people in purgatory and things like this. And it's also this thing of a different religion. And they weren't allowed to even set foot inside each other's churches. And so this is just a great story. This is my, for me, it's a neat story, was that the Catholic priest finally came to our gathering, Little Protestant gathering. For the first time, it was the Protestant churches were going to go to the Catholic church and celebrate Thanksgiving together, right? And so I'm a pastor, and I'm the only woman, and that's a big deal too. You know, we're all sitting up there up front, and you know, it's this wonderful, wonderful service. And we sang the last hymn, walking down the aisle, and people sticking their hands out the aisle, welcome, welcome, you know, welcome. And then the whole church floods around us, all the pastors in the back of the church, and everybody's talking to us. I'm so glad my neighbor is in your church. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad another person brings up her little girl. Maybe someday we'll be like this too. And you know, it was just the most, for this tiny, dusty little village, it was this really cool, amazing thing, you know.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
We have a new bishop in South Dakota, second woman bishop in the United States, Andrea Grootnestal. And so there's our new bishop. Catholic bishop, I guess, is relatively conservative concerning issues of women and ordination. So he's having quite a time getting together with Andrea and Bishop Andrea. So there's been a lot of new sort of interesting tensions between Lutherans and Catholics about how just even in public they're functioning together. And she's pretty feisty and has made a contribution already to sort of barge her way in and say, here I am. So. Okay, we'll consider this discussion closed, and tomorrow we'll be looking at sort of two approaches to how we talk about these differences, one from a sermon of a colleague's of mine and another from what I call sort of this distinction between modern and postmodern, and we'll look at that kind of landscape together. Okay? All right, thank you.
Thank you.